is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Tom Jossen and Bill Rajov, senior fellows of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. They and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal, a chronicle, an analysis of the vast canvas of the Ummah and the jihadist operating across several continents. We begin, however, with the news from Afghanistan. Though the U.S. and its allies have departed Afghanistan, the crisis is bigger than ever. This is headlines in these last hours from London. As sanctions bite, Afghanistan edges towards famine. Nearly 9 million people, reads the subhead, are close to starvation, surpassing even Syria and Yemen, the UN Food Agency warns. This conjoins with reporting from Kabul by the Daily Telegraph, pointing out that not only are people without daily confidence of food security, but that also the hospital system, the main hospital for people in Kabul, has collapsed. There was a photograph of three infants in one incubator, another photograph of a mother who herself was clearly under the weather, maybe starving, holding the hand of one of her children in a bed in one direction, and an infant on what appeared to be a feeding tube in the other part of the bed. This is a catastrophe. I'm seeing that the EU is paying attention to it. I know the UN has. But we're looking at evidence that the Taliban is not a government. We also have reason to believe the banking system, such as it is, collapsing. So, gentlemen, we have concentrated on warfighting. At what point does it become obvious? I think we've passed that point, that the Taliban is not a government, was never fighting to become a government. They are a gang. Their job is murder, homicide. And what we can imagine now, the concerns of Afghanistan becoming a staging area for more ahead, that does not account for 9 million people now at the edge of starvation and the rest of the population that could be come winter. Tom, your thoughts on these things and the Taliban making noise that the U.S. Congress has to pass it money. There's no reason to believe that any money given the Taliban will go to feeding the Afghanistan people. Good evening to you, Tom.
Good evening, John. You know, John, I testified before the Senate Banking Committee about this several weeks ago. And the point that I made and that several other witnesses made was that if the U.S. or its allies want to help the Afghan people, then it should explore opportunities when it comes to sort of non-fungible hard foodstuffs, you know, things that are not easy to be basically translated into cash or sold for cash. And the reason for that is that nobody trusts the Taliban, of course, to use any money it's given or anything that it can be easily turned into cash to do what's right here to take care of the people. Now, John, I think that they're, you know, the Taliban absolutely fought for 20 years alongside al-Qaeda to resurrect the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. They want a government. They want to be a regime. They want to be respected. They want to function as a government. They inherited all the problems that they helped unleash, ironically enough, inside Afghanistan against the Afghan government. You know, they spent, you know, 20 years undermining the Afghan government. Well, all the problems that they helped. So now the Afghan government had all of its own problems, of course, but all of those problems have been compounded and new problems that were created by the Taliban and al-Qaeda. They now own that as a government, as a regime. So these are really problems that they're going to have to figure out how to solve if they want to maintain a hold on Afghanistan. And I would just say, finally, you know, there are other bad actors in the world that supported the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan, either rhetorically or otherwise. And we're very quick to have diplomacy with them and even float the idea of recognizing, including the Chinese, the Iranians, the Pakistanis, and even the Russians, you know, leaders of the Taliban. Those parties, you know, if this is their regime, if this is a government and a regime that they want to recognize, they should be willing to deal with them and give them aid. It's not up to the U.S. to do that after all these years.
Bill, I recall the reporting that you did just a week past of appointments in the government of provinces in Afghanistan. Two prominent jihadists. One was a Haqqani family, as I recall. Another man who has been responsible for murder and mayhem for many decades, and he was presumed dead. Neither of those men seemed fit to worry about famine, hospital collapse, and banking collapse. Is that a fair summary of these characters, Bill?
Good evening, John. Yeah, and so, look, the Taliban wants to have a government, but their idea of what a government, what's important to them, isn't necessarily what's important to us or even the Afghan people. The Taliban's number one priority is enforcing its harsh version of Sharia or Islamic law. That's what it deems to be important. That's what it deems or that's what it believes is the most important thing it can provide to the Afghan people to ensure they're living properly under Islamic law. And if that means people have to starve or be poor or you know, not have medical care, those are secondary or tertiary things for the Taliban. And so I think once we understand that, we can understand why these types of things are happening. Again, the Taliban just doesn't, they don't care about those would be nice to haves. They'd like to have that money from the banks. They would certainly want the international community to provide aid to fund their government. But at the end of the day, as long as it's ruling and imposing its version of Sharia, that's all it really cares about.
Tom, the Associated Press last week passed this item on that Foreign Minister Amir Khan Muttaqi of Afghanistan, the Taliban, said in a statement posted online that the frozen assets in the U.S. are harming the public from the health sector to education and other services. His comments came a day after the World Food Program warned that millions of people in Afghanistan are facing poverty. So what the Taliban is doing is accusing the U.S. of being the cause for the collapse of the infrastructure, which is far-fetched and at the same time credible to our enemies and our adversaries. I add this. The United Nations pushed for urgent action to prop up Afghanistan's banks, warning that a spike in people unable to repay loans, lower deposits, and a cash liquidity crunch could cause the financial system to collapse. That is, that the money that is barely useful now outside the country would not be useful inside the country. Tom, we're entertaining the possibility of a country that's just going to fail, that the lights are going to go out, that they won't be able to maintain this. Is that credible to you, Tom, that this is not a North Korean model? This is not a Syrian model. This is something entirely new, a non-governed state that just simply fails.
You know, I think it's pretty early to say that, John. I mean, remember, you're still only just about just over three months after the fall of Kabul. I think the Taliban is still trying to get its government fully entrenched in different areas, and it has inherited all these different problems. But, you know, when it comes to money at the banks, you know, the Taliban is acting like this is their money or this is just Afghanistan's money. But remember, the U.S. taxpayer spent hundreds of billions of dollars on Afghanistan through the last 20 years. You know, a lot of the money that flowed through the Afghan government, was very largely supported by donor money, including by the U.S. government. This was not exactly money that the Taliban earned or something for humanitarian purposes. This was most likely money that came out of American coffers and that was ultimately, you know, basically American taxpayers paid for. There's no reason to give this money to the Taliban to do whatever they want with it when we know we can't trust them in any way. That's why I think the issue keeps coming back to trying to find if the U.S. and its allies are going to insist on providing some sort of support in Afghanistan for the Afghan people. One, they should look at NGOs and demand that the Taliban let them work through NGOs to do so. And two, it should be in the form of medicine and supplies and food and stuff that's not easily can't be easily traded for cash.
Tom Jocelyn and Bill Raggio are senior fellows of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They keep the Long War Journal. ISIS is in the land. Reuters tells us that ISIS is now operating in all 34 provinces in Afghanistan, but it's non-transparent. We cannot know. We do know that ISIS is in the world. And when we come back, a report at Long War Journal about ISIS activity in Uganda, in East Africa. There's also reason to believe that ISIS is prospering in Nigeria. It's coming holiday time, Christmas time, and ISIS is a threat, especially now. We've seen the pattern in the past. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Raggio and Tom Jocelyn of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. We can peer into Afghanistan somewhat with the reports of famine and hospital collapse and banking collapse. We can assume that ISIS is prospering as a as what you'd have to say a threat to the to the Taliban, but not a government threat, a threat of bombing, of turmoil. But ISIS is not limited in its activities to Afghanistan. Bill, I come to you because the Islamic State, it is without a territory now, although I note that Northeast Nigeria is said to be under the control of an ISIS branch. But how does ISIS present itself to all these places? You have a report of them operating in Uganda. Are they a gang? Are they a tribe? Are they claiming some aspect of the proper of the land where they're operating as their caliphate?
Yeah, John, the Islamic State in Africa is a far better position than it is in Afghanistan and some other regions. There, it's what it's done is essentially take over elements of the Al-Qaeda network since the split in the mid to 2010s. And it's, you know, assumed elements of jihadist groups there. And it's acting in effective manner. It's directly competing with Al-Qaeda branches, JNIM and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, other Shabab, not so well in Somalia as it is in some other places. But Al-Qaeda's Central Africa province is actually doing quite well. And they're taking the fight not just into the Congo, but into Uganda and other places. And you're correct. In Nigeria, the Islamic State has largely subsumed Boko Haram, a element that was previously friendly with Al-Qaeda. It's a very complicated situation. But yeah, the Islamic State has in Africa, I think it's probably is where the Islamic State currently is strongest, far stronger than in Afghanistan.
And it and growing in Africa because it assumes the Al-Qaeda network. It assumes the roving bands that have been like Boko Haram, I think, has been overwhelmed with elements of ISIS. So the radical method, you know, it seems to work. And I come to you, Tom, about that radical method. It is Christmas time. I remember indistinctly, and now I check it out. It was 2016, a December attack in 2016 in Germany against a Christmas market. To your measure, Tom, with all of these security concerns at the same time of the pandemic, has European Union let down its guard? Is it now vulnerable again to ISIS bad actors at Christmas?
You know, it's always tough to say, John. I mean, there's always a steady stream of threats that counterterrorism and intelligence officials have to take into account and try and ward off. You know, it's really a matter of, you know, if they can get one through those defenses. You know, I think there's always a steady stream of threats. It's just a matter of whether or not they're successful this time where they weren't the last. Now, you mentioned the 2016 attack. The jihadis have really had their eyes on Christmas markets and Christmas parades and churches and that type of thing for a long time around Christmas time to carry out attacks. There's a whole string of plots going even back to before 2001, before 9/11 in this vein. So this is something that I think that the U.S. and its allies around the world will absolutely have to keep an eye out for here during the holiday season.
And the two attacks in Britain most recently, the attack that assassinated a member of parliament, and then the what appears to be a failed bombing attack, at least a premature bombing attack, were those in any way connected to ISIS, or was that just jihadist radical recruiting in general, Tom? How did that come out?
You know, I'm not even sure yet. I have to look at do a deep dive into those cases to figure that out. I think that part of the problem here is that there's a whole range of possibilities when it comes to how jihadists can carry out these attacks. But we've noticed, however, over time is that the jihadis who are connected to the mothership in some way tend to be more lethal than just somebody who's just a lone actor. Now, you have exceptions like that, like the Orlando shooting, of course, some years ago. But more often than not, the people who are really the most troublesome, the most worrisome are those who are networked, who have some sort of affiliation or connection with professionals who can help amplify their bad thoughts.
And Bill, I come back to Afghanistan again, because we keep watching it, asking ourselves, is this a staging ground for more radical activity? What is your measure now? Because I don't see any particular a sizable organization. I do note that the EU has been meeting about it and concerned about it. They met recently at Dushanbe, the capital of Tajikistan, concerned with what the Taliban might do. Does the Taliban look to be more lethal or more substantive? Does it look to be gathering recruits from across the world? Or is it still, as you say, sorting out who runs the provinces and who runs the opium trade? Because I note there was an article during the week that it's revived despite the fact that the Taliban is now in governance.
Yeah, that's a great point. On the last point, first, real quick, you know, the Taliban says it's, you know, anti-opium and all these things. And yet, of course, if you read those articles that have came out, they're permitting it. And that's because they get a big cut of that and they like that money. So the Taliban isn't as Islamic as it pretends to be, at least when it comes to things like reaping funds on the opium trade. It's hard to know what the Taliban is actually doing and what they're thinking. We could only surmise. I think it's wise to. So first of all, the Taliban's allies are Al Qaeda, the remnants of the Islamic movement, Uzbekistan, groups like Ansarullah, which is a party that operates in Tajikistan, the movement of Taliban in Pakistan, Lashkar-e-Taiba. There's a host of groups in the region that have supported the Taliban's insurgency and helped them come to power. The Taliban gives them safe haven in the country and access to training camps. So that's all still happening. We can be certain the Taliban isn't expelling them. We'd know if that was happening. Whether these groups are now like plotting external attacks from Afghanistan, again, we don't have information. The Taliban would be wise to keep a lid on this, to ask these groups to give them time to consolidate and not bring the heat on them so soon after taking over the country. But, you know, that's what I would do if I was the Taliban. But I can't tell you that that's what they're saying. But then again, you know, you have Pakistan and you have other, you know, remains a safe haven for groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba and other jihadist groups that are supported by the state. It's, again, very difficult. The fact that the Taliban controls Afghanistan means that all bets are off. We know what happened the last time they were in control of the country. We got Al Qaeda. We know they maintain close relationships with these groups. The Taliban claims Al Qaeda and other terrorist groups aren't even in country, that they haven't been there since 2001. We know that's a lie. So the Taliban can't be trusted. So the real threat emanating from the from Afghanistan is a Taliban controlled Afghanistan, because A, the Taliban can't be trusted. B, they still have those ties to the jihadist groups, and see, those jihadist groups are still operating in Afghanistan to this day.
Bill Rajo and Tom Johnson, they are senior fellows for the Foundation of Democracies. And I add this because it is within these last hours from Dushanbe. The European Union's top diplomat on Monday, these hours, urged Afghanistan's northern neighbors, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, northern neighbors, to help prevent what he described as the abuse of migrants by political goals by the Belarusian authorities. In other words, the European Union, what it's concerned about is that Belarus or other bad actors will bring in Afghanistan migrants, refugees, and force them into the EU. The EU's major concern with Afghanistan is migration. That's where the European Union is. Knowing there's famine, knowing there's a hospital collapse, they're worried about migrants. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.